Welcome to My IELTS Classroom, the podcast where two ex-examiners talk all things IELTS. I'm Shelley Cornick.
And I'm Nick Long.
And today we have a question and answer session. Can we use words like however and moreover in informal letters?
No.
Is your writing automatically penalised if it's under length?
Not anymore.
And in academic writing task one, should you write a separate overview or can you put it together with your introduction?
It doesn't matter.
Morning, Nick. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing all right today. Thanks. How are you?
Yeah, you look very bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I'm good, although honestly I'm a little bit annoyed because on Friday I got my hair cut. I've got a very nice hairdresser and she asked me if I'd been watching. We were chatting about what we'd been watching, like what TV series. Mm-hmm. And she asked me if I'd watched Lupin. That's French, Nick. It's a French TV series. Have you seen it on Netflix?
No.
It's like some kind of... It's a kind of like revenge story. It's kind of cool. It's like a thriller action. It's a man. He steals a necklace to try and revenge his father's death. But she said to me, like, maybe you should watch it. So I had a look. It was 5 hours.
I thought,
that's quite good, right? 5 hours.
Yeah.
So started watching it on Saturday. Yesterday, thought, I'm going to finish it. There's 3 hours left. So I stayed up until 2 a.m. to watch. And in the final episode, I kept thinking, I don't know how they're going to finish this within the hour. Episode 5 finished, Nick. It was the first half of the season.
Oh, dear.
And the second half comes out late in 2021. So what a waste of time, basically. So I'm quite tired because I was up so late watching Lupin. Although the reason I'm mentioning this is... It was really interesting because it's French, they had a voiceover.
Right.
Which I'm going to be honest was not very good. It did, for me, the voices didn't really match the people, but I got used to it. But I also had the English subtitles. And I have got no idea how they did this. But basically, the subtitles and the voiceover were almost... In every sentence, 100% different. But they were right. It was just two alternative possible translations.
Right.
So, like, they might say, oh, this will be difficult. And in the written words, it will say, this will be really hard.
Yep.
Or, like, he might say, oh, we should meet tomorrow. And the subtitle said, let's get together tomorrow. So... If anybody's listening and they want a lesson in, like, if you just want to see, find loads of synonyms... While watching, I'm not going to say it's brilliant, but it's a decent French thriller kind of program, then I do recommend Lupin. But you might want to wait until late 2021 so you can watch all of it and not just half of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have no idea how they did that.
I would guess that probably the people who did the audio dub were different from the people who did the subtitles.
They must have been different, but the fact that... It was just almost like every single word was different. There was, it was almost like you couldn't, if you tried to do it like that, it would be impossible to have them. But 99% of the time, they did actually have, both of them were accurate meanings. But it was a really interesting way of seeing how a translation can have a different feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, if you do watch Lupin, I like saying it in the French way, Lupin, then the spoken translation for me is better than the written translation. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Generally, I'm not a very big fan of dubbing. I prefer to watch in the original language with subtitles, even if I don't understand that language.
Well, actually, I've later found out that there's an option to do that on Netflix. And I think if I hadn't been so interested in the whole synonym action, I think I would have gone back because I also watched, there's a Spanish series. Have you seen it? Money Heist.
Nope.
That's very good. The first season's very good anyway. And I almost couldn't watch it because the dubbing was driving me crazy. And then I discovered that you can switch it off and it was much better.
Yeah. Javier Bardem?
Huh?
Javier Bardem?
No, it's not Javier Bardem. Oh. There's no one that famous in it. But it is excellent. It is excellent. All right, so that's our TV roundup for the week. I hope everybody enjoyed that. This is not a TV podcast, though. It's an IELTS podcast. And today, we like these episodes, don't we, Nick?
We love them.
Yes, today we're going to be answering all of the questions that you sent in this week. I don't know how many they are, but There's at least 20 or 30. Before we start answering the questions, though, one thing kind of shocked me this week, Nick, as the questions were coming in, which was that a lot of people obviously listen to our podcast every week.
Right.
But people seem to have no idea that this podcast is not our full-time activity, right? This is like the tiny piece of what we do each week. And that actually what Nick and I spend 95% of our time doing each week is teaching lessons in our live daily lessons, marking essays for students, and basically just supporting everybody who signs up to our main website, myieltsclassroom.com. I don't usually talk very much about the main website because I just assume that people realise it's there. But based on a lot of the questions, I don't think that people do. So if you are interested in watching, I think, the highest quality IELTS videos for writing and grammar, go to our website. You can watch the first 12 lessons for free. If you're interested in having live lessons every day with Nick or myself or our other teacher, Juliet, sign up for our bronze writing package. It's $34.99, and that gives you access to all of the videos and up to 20 lessons, right, throughout the month.
Yep, for a month, 20,
Yeah, for reading, writing, and listening. It is amazing value, and that is where we do all of our main teaching.
Yep.
This is something that Nick and I do because we just, to be honest, for me, I just like seeing Nick once a week, right?
It's a good our weekly meeting, isn't it, kind of?
Yeah. It's like Monday morning, how am I going to start the week? I'm going to have a nice chat to Nick. We're going to help people in the process. But this is just something that we do really for a bit of fun. We started in lockdown because we were both isolated.
Yeah.
So if you're, you know, this is great, and I know that this podcast helps people, but if you're really serious and you're really looking for a comprehensive course, please, please, please go to our website. That's where you will find all of our blog posts, all of our video lessons, and you can sign up for our intensive courses. So I just wanted to say that, as I said, don't usually like advertising, but I do feel some people could benefit from going to the page. So that said, let's get on with the questions. We've got a lot, Nick. So what I've done is I've tried to separate them into just parts, like different parts of the test, right? So because I would consider you a speaking expert, I'm going to ask you, we've only actually got one question about speaking, and it's from a lady called Aya.
Right.
And she says, I have a question that I wish you can answer on one of your podcasts. When I speak in my head, my English is almost perfect. I don't have a hard time expressing my ideas, but when I try to speak, I feel like a three-year-old girl struggling to make sense. Please, what can I do? I still have another month to prepare. All right. So I think that's an interesting question, Nick. As somebody who personally struggles to speak a second language, I can definitely identify with being able to sit. You know, often before I go to a shop or I make a telephone call, I sit and practice what I'm going to say in my head. And it's perfect. And then the minute I have to actually speak those words, it's really not perfect. You're a much better second language speaker than me. So do you have that problem?
Sometimes. I definitely did that when I lived in Russia. I was definitely doing that, like, before I went somewhere or did something, I would think about what I wanted to say. And then a lot of the time it would come out wrong or with a mistake or just gobbledygook, basically.
So what do you think's happening when that happens? I've got an idea, but what do you think?
I think it might just be nervousness.
I think that's definitely an element. Yeah.
Like, I think it's, for me, the biggest thing with Russian was I always tried to speak perfectly. And I always made mistakes. And then I remember one day I was actually, it was 2 o'clock in the morning and I was stood on, what's the name of the Rubinsteiner Street in St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
And there was the, I was with one of our mutual friends, Mike, and we were chatting to some girls and she kept telling me that my Russian was really bad.
Really?
And but her English was even worse, so whatever. But from that moment, I just decided, right, I'm tired of like trying to speak perfectly, so I'm just going to say whatever I want. And from that moment, my Russian became much better.
So you essentially
just stopped caring about making mistakes.
Right. That's interesting.
And then confidence came with that.
Yeah.
Because even if I didn't say something perfectly, the person who I was talking to understood exactly what I meant. Because I wasn't fumbling around trying to find a word or stuttering or, you know.
So you were just focusing on pauses, communicating
the idea that I wanted to communicate, yeah, with mistakes if necessary.
Well, I think you may have hit on something, because Aya says, you know, I feel like a 3-year-old girl struggling to make sense. You know, Aya, mm-hmm, I've never heard you speak, but I am pretty sure you don't sound
yeah,
like a 3-year-old child. I think you're probably putting quite a lot of pressure on yourself.
I think pressure is probably what it is, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I know from my experience that maybe for me, because my Russian is not as high level as Nick's, is that maybe when I have this problem, it's because I hear a lot of Russian around me every day, mm-hmm, right? So I know what the words should sound like.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a big difference between knowing what a word sounds like and actually being able to create that sound.
Yeah, it takes from your own a long time and a lot of
mouth.
Practice. It,
mm-hmm. Exactly. So maybe part of what you're struggling with, Aya, is just literally some basic pronunciation. I mean, I talk about feeling words in your mouth. You have to kind of understand how each word feels.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe instead of speaking in your head all the time,
mm-hmm,
maybe, you know, in a room where there's nobody else, so you don't look like a crazy person, maybe actually voice what you're thinking just to get the feeling of the words in your mouth. Because it's like any motor skill. The more you do it, the easier it becomes.
Mm-hmm. One small little anecdote again.
Yeah, go.
I had a good friend in university who actually lived in St. Petersburg as well, and his Russian was absolutely flawless.
Really?
His accent was, you couldn't distinguish,
wow,
that he was a non-native. And that's because he used to spend hours practicing in front of the mirror. He'd write down things that he heard people say and practice it in front of the mirror. And I think there's something in that.
100%. I mean, we've spoken in previous episodes about how you don't need an American or British accent to score well.
No.
Mm-hmm. In the test. But I do think, as you said, I think we've advised this before, listening to a native speaker speaking, pausing and repeating that,
mm-hmm,
getting the feeling of the intonation, like you said,
mm-hmm,
I think that makes a big difference.
Yep, definitely.
But I think Nick and I have given you sort of two things there. They're quite different. One, be a bit more confident. Just focus on communicating what you want to say. You don't need to be perfect to get a high score in IELTS.
Yep.
And maybe practice less in your head. And mm-hmm, more out loud.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. All right, well, I hope that helps. I think Aya's got a couple of extra questions a bit further down. Let's move then from speaking to reading.
Mm.
So the first, well, it's not really a question, it's more like a statement. It's from a student called Akoji, who says, I'm finding the reading section very difficult and ambiguous.
Mm.
So, okay, we don't have much to go on there, right? So it's difficult to know exactly what Akoji's finding difficult, but it's the word ambiguous,
mm,
that makes me think that maybe Akoji, I think the problem could be that maybe your vocabulary or your language level isn't quite high enough,
mm,
to understand the precise meaning of some of the words in the reading.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Nick and I, we both teach an intensive reading course. Do you ever find that, you know, when you're teaching the reading, that there's an answer which is you're not sure if it's correct or not?
Yeah, for sure. There's always those kind of answers, especially if it's the sort of higher level vocabulary where you need to look for synonyms or understanding the meaning of a sentence to right, get the answer.
Exactly. But I would probably say that for us,
mm-hmm,
because we perfectly understand it,
mm-hmm,
it's always very clear
for us
what,
yeah,
mm-hmm, what the answer is, mm-hmm, or isn't. So usually when students are like, well, I don't understand if this is false or not given, or why is this the summary for the heading?
Mm-hmm.
It's usually because they don't really understand the language precisely enough to be able to make a decision. So it's hard for me to give you advice, Akoji, but I would say if you know the answers and you still don't understand the answers, that's usually a language problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I'm afraid, you know, come back to us if you want to, you know, tell us a particular question that you find difficult, or if there's, you know, give us an example of what you find ambiguous. But I would say that's probably all I can offer you at this time. Regina, though, wants to know, what are the best methods to adopt in the reading test to get a band 8?
There are many methods, I suppose, aren't there?
Yeah, right.
I suppose the best advice we could give is probably read once, read well.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of students try to read the text first and then answer the questions.
Mm-hmm.
But you really need to be analysing and spending a lot of time with the questions before you start reading the text.
Definitely.
Which is going to make it much easier, much faster.
Right. I mean, I think when people come to us with reading problems, there's sort of two groups with opposite problems that produce the same result, which is that they don't get the answers or they take too long.
Mm-hmm.
The first group is, as you said, Nick, people who read the whole text and ignore the questions and then come back to them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can do that with IELTS. You should be reading, actively reading to find the answers. Maybe a more common problem, though, is people who are only looking for the answers and therefore they are just relying on scanning and skimming.
Mm-hmm.
And you are never going to be able to get more than a 6 or a 6.5, I don't think, if you're purely scanning and skimming and trying to match keywords.
Yeah.
Firstly, because some of the questions can't be answered at all by scanning or skimming. Headings, multiple choice questions, information match.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, you don't say if you're a general training or a academic student, but particularly for academic students, those texts are difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're just scanning and trying to match keywords, you're almost never really going to fully understand the text, and therefore you're never going to fully understand the questions. So the reason we love Read Once, Read Well is, number one, you analyze the questions first, right? So you know what you're reading for. And number two, you are actually reading the text. So many students come to us with reading problems and actually they're not reading at all. They're just reading little parts of sentences and trying to use their logic, and that doesn't work. So I would say definitely when we say read once, read well, Regina, we mean read the text and try and answer once and try and answer all the questions at the same time, simultaneously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the quickest way to do it. It ensures that you're actually reading the text and understanding it. And if you still can't get a band 9, once you're doing that, it's probably, again, that your language is not high enough, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. All right. Now, the final question about reading is from Sarah Moss from Brazil, who said, I'd really like to know more about the logic behind true, false, not given questions, since I am struggling with these. Well, first of all, I would say, Sarah, go to episode 24, because we've got a whole hour podcast episode about true, false, not given, how to approach them, what are the two different types of keywords. I mean, that is like our comprehensive answer. But if you had to, in a nutshell, God, don't use that in your writing, please, listeners. Right? But in a nutshell, Nick, if you could summarize the logic beyond true, false, not given, would you be able to do it in this quick sentence now before Sarah goes to that episode?
Do I know the truth?
Yeah. Why is that important? So if you ask yourself, do you know the truth?
Mm-hmm.
You basically can always identify if the answer is true, false, or not given. So why is that question important, Nick?
Because if the question says, for example, Shelley is in her 30s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do we have an answer which tells us Shelley's age?
Right.
If we do. So
do you know the truth? Yeah, do you know how old I am?
Yeah. Yeah. And if we do have an answer, then it's only going to be true or false.
Exactly. Because if it tells you I'm 39, we know that I'm in my 30s. If it tells you I'm 45, we know we're not in the 40s, right? So if you know the truth, you know if it's true or false.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know the truth,
it's not given.
It's not given, yeah, because you don't know if I'm in my 30s because there's not enough information.
Mm-hmm.
So I would always say to you, any student, when you're making a decision on true, false, not given, do you know the truth? If you do, then you know it's either true or false. And if you don't know, it's not given. If that is just sounds just as confusing as you have before, just listen to that episode because we've got a practice reading. We go through everything step by step. Mm-hmm. I think that will help you. But yeah. All right. Good. So I've spoken quite a lot, Nick. So maybe let's switch to writing then.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you read this? The first, we've only got one question for general training writing task one.
Can we use the words however and moreover, etc., in informal letters, which we already answered in the introduction?
Yeah, we did. With a big no tomorrow.
No,
you
we
can't.
Yeah. It's not informal language, is it?
It's the absolute opposite of informal language. And it, you know, I think we mentioned this last week. I understand you've been studying essays. You've learned all of these transition signals.
Mm-hmm.
But those are academic words. They are not the language that we use in an informal letter. So I would say using however, maybe you might be able to use however. But moreover.
Definitely not.
Would be an automatic six mm-hmm. for task achievement because you're. Letter would have a mixed tone.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put a lot of them, you might even get a five mm-hmm. because it could be an inappropriate tone. Mm-hmm. What you're looking for in letters, and even in formal letters, to be honest, Tamara, unless it's a letter of complaint, I don't think that you really also can't use these transition signals there either.
Mm.
What you really want to be using is what we call discourse markers. These are other ways of joining sentences together. Maybe we'll have a look at those in a future episode. Mm-hmm. They're part of, I don't know if you're signed up to our video course, but they're in lesson 13, if my memory serves me right. Letters of news and explanation, lesson 13 in the general training course. But definitely don't use transition signals. And you can also go and watch lesson 4, which is a free lesson. And that will explain all of the different types of language, which is suitable for the different types of tone.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was an easy, simple question. Mm-hmm. No. All right. Let's move then. We've got more questions for writing task one, academic. So why don't you start reading us through those, mate?
Okay, the first question, again, which we've already answered in the introduction, was, is it better to separate the overview in a different paragraph or put it together with the intro paragraph in writing task one? And the answer is, it's up to you. It's your choice.
Nobody cares. Right, yeah. I mean, I teach it to put it in a separate paragraph mm-hmm. purely because the overview is the most important paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
in your report. And if you don't have an overview that contains the key features, you can't get more than a six. So for me, I separate them out. If you want to put them together, it really doesn't matter. As long as you've got that overview,
mm-hmm.
that's all that matters. Which leads to the second question.
Mm-hmm. Is a conclusion necessary for writing task one? Your overview is kind of your conclusion, isn't it, I suppose?
Well, yeah. I mean, a conclusion basically is the place in an essay where you summarize mm-hmm. everything you've already discussed in the essay, right? Mm-hmm. Well, in writing task one, we don't have any opinions.
We don't. No.
We don't have any arguments. So there's no need for a conclusion because there's nothing to conclude.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, Nick, that's what happens. I think students get a bit confused between what is an overview and what is a conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as I said, a conclusion is where you repeat the arguments at the end
mm-hmm.
to summarize. An overview is where you tell the examiner in your own words what you think are the main general trends or the key features of that chart. No mm-hmm. statistics, just, you know, if you were looking at the chart and telephoning your friend and you had to explain what the chart shows, the two sentences you would do to summarize that.
Yep.
That is your overview.
Mm-hmm.
You've already asked, can I put that in the intro paragraph or separately? It doesn't matter. You could put that at the end of your report if you wanted to. There's no rule about this.
No, that's true. Mm.
For me, it would be a huge mistake to do that, though, because mm-hmm. by understanding the key features before you start writing the specific details paragraphs, you know how to organize those paragraphs mm-hmm. correctly. And you've already shown the examiner, hey, I know how IELTS works. Here's my overview with the key features. You can relax, right? Because you're not looking for those now.
Mm.
And I can relax. So basically, no, if you've got an overview, either in the first sentence or in the second separate paragraph, don't repeat that information at the end. There is no need for a conclusion. Right. Next question. I think this is kind of an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
How much? So this is a question about the vocabulary in task one. How much should the difference in percentage be to say that there was a significant increase or decrease? Or how much should the percentage be, like the difference be, if we say that it was a slight increase? Is there any rough estimate of numbers, Shaha?
This is a really good question, actually.
Yeah.
And I would say there is not really a rough estimate of numbers, to be honest. No. I think you're really going to have to look at the whole chart and decide for yourself where the big increases are, where the small increases are, and then label them accordingly. You're going to have, if it's a line graph, for example, you're going to have a lot of ups and downs. And uh-huh. you will be able to use your own sort of ability to see like what's in front of you, what constitutes a significant increase mm-hmm. and what constitutes a slight increase. Now, it could be the case that when something doubles, it's a slight increase because in comparison with the rest of the data, an increase of 100% is actually quite small.
This is the thing. I think it's interesting. Yeah, I totally agree, Nick. He says, is there a rough estimate of numbers? Well, if I said to you, I don't know, 10% is a significant increase. Mm-hmm. Well, if all of the numbers are 80% plus, 10% is actually quite a small increase.
It's a slight increase, yeah, a small one.
But mm-hmm. if all of the numbers, you know, are like 5%,
mm-hmm. then 10% becomes significant, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So you've got to just sort of like look at what's happening, as Nick said, look at what's happening with all of the items in the chart. And compared to the other items, is that significant or is that slight?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know, don't use an adjective,
yeah,
right?
I suppose.
Of course, we're going to give more points. We want to see some adjectives or some adverbs in your report. But if, you know, also, you could just use moderate. that would be the cop-out. But I would say you've got to just, you know, there are some things we can teach and there are some things where, like little birds, we have to throw you into the air and watch you fly. And I think for this one, it's a case of use your own logic. If you think it's significant, it probably is. But look at what's happening overall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. And the last question, this is maybe moving us forward to some of the questions we got for essays. This is for IELTS Academic. How do I answer writing task one? Line graph, table, pie chart, bar chart, etc. So I would say,
I'm sure we have an episode on this.
Well, we do have an episode on writing task one. I would say the very short answer is you're going to want three things. You're going to want an introduction. You're going to want an overview, which has got those key features. And then you're going to want specific details, paragraphs, which actually give me the statistics and tell me what happened in that chart. There are two types of charts. Well, there's more, but I would divide those charts into charts that show change. You're going to need some language that describes increases and decreases and fluctuations.
Mm-hmm.
There are some charts which just compare items. So then you're going to have language about, you know, highest, lowest, majority.
Mm-hmm.
Asking a question like this, though, such a broad question, maybe shows me that you're just starting IELTS because there's no way that we could answer that question in a 1 hour podcast.
No way.
So I would direct you to our academic task one course. It's about 10 hours. I think that's the amount of time you need to really understand how to tackle all of the types of chart. Well, the first three lessons are free. Watch those. They will give you a general idea about what you're going to need to do. But I would say, basically, how do you answer writing task one? You learn all of the skills and the language that is necessary. And then actually, for me personally, it's the easiest one of all of the writing tasks.
Wow.
I can do those all day, every day, because they are quite formulaic, right? There's a definite system that you can use. But unfortunately, can't do that today on the podcast. But go myieltsclassroom.com and, yeah, just have a look at those first three lessons, because they give sort of like the general idea about what we're looking for.
Hey, hi Shelley, this is Mercy from India. My favorite IELTS classroom lessons are related to hedging and articles.
Hey, this is Essen. Every lesson of my IELTS classroom is my favorite lesson. because each one of it teaches you a unique skill which is vital for the IELTS exam.
In the same way, Nick, if we move on to essays, I got three or four people who said, you know, I'm always confused about how to organise an essay to get a 7 for task achievement and coherence and cohesion, mm-hmm. or even just... what is the strategy for writing task 2? Or please give me advice on how the structure of the essay should be.
Wow. Very broad general questions.
Very broad general questions. I mean, I know how I want to answer those questions. Sometimes it's just with a scream. But what would you say to a student who asked you that?
I would say something similar to what you just said to the previous question. These people are probably just starting out. I think if it takes 10 hours to learn the strategy for task 1, mm-hmm. you want to at least double that for task 2.
Yeah.
It's not an easy process, and there's a lot to learn. There's a lot of things you need to know about how to answer the question, about how to structure your essay, and it's something that is impossible to teach in a one-hour podcast.
Right. And I would also say, I think the thing is that the feeling I get from these type of questions, you know, how do I organise an essay? What should the structure of the essay be? There is not one
answer.
Structure mm-hmm. or one mm-hmm. answer. There's not one type of IELTS essay, right? Mm-hmm. Like you could be asked to write a discussion essay, an argumentative essay, a problem solution essay, an advantages disadvantages essay. And although there are some skills which are the same for every essay, mm-hmm. like, you know, we want topic sentences, we want introductions that tell us what will be discussed, each essay has got its own small differences, maybe the language that's used, mm-hmm. the order that you present information. And I would just strongly recommend to all three of these students, so Smit, Naveen and Bobby, stop trying to think of looking for one template mm-hmm. that will cover all of the essays and simplify what is a high-level skill. And just maybe understand that essay writing, it's not really difficult, but it's also not really easy. Mm-hmm. But it's something you need to invest some time in.
Yeah, it's an investment, isn't it? It's true.
It is an investment. But once you actually invest that time, all of these sort of like all of the confusion and the difficulty actually just disappears because you start to understand that there is a real logic to mm-hmm. writing essays or essay writing. It's not my logic. This is the logic of hundreds of years of people writing academic English. Mm-hmm. And you just need to get on top of those. And I would also say, you know, in terms of organization, okay, Smit, you said, how do I organize an essay to get a 7 in task response and coherence and cohesion? Well, organizing the essay is not going to affect your task response score at all. And actually, if we look at coherence and cohesion, the order of the paragraphs is extremely small part of what we're looking for, isn't mm-hmm. it, in coherence and cohesion. So I would say so many students get really paranoid about organization, whereas essentially for most IELTS essays you've only got two paragraphs. So there's not really much to learn in terms of that. You want to be focusing on the other skills. So again, though, if you're looking for an introduction, go and watch the first three videos in our essay writing course, which does explain about paragraphing, the order of the paragraphs, and that will give you an overview, but it is still just an overview. Okay, I think that's all I can say about that.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I have thought about trying to do an episode where we talk about organisation, but every time I do, I just think it's just, we're trying to make, oversimplify something, which actually oversimplifying in a way makes it more confusing. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think that's not something, yeah, no. I just don't want to do it, because although I could do it in about 15 minutes, I don't think it's actually going to help people, to be honest. If you can't learn organisation without learning the other bits.
It comes as part of the package, doesn't it, with everything else?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Then the other question that we answered mm-hmm. in the introduction, is your writing automatically penalised if it is under length?
So the answer is no, but it used to be, but it's not anymore.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. It used to be that we would just take points, depending on how much it was under length. Mm-hmm. We would take points just automatically from your task response. That doesn't happen now. That changed, I think, over a year ago now, maybe even 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. But if you're writing, I don't know, let's say 100 words in task one, you probably haven't covered all of the bullets if you're a general training student, or discussed all of the items if you're an academic student. And then you will definitely then still be punished or penalized for task achievement. Same for an essay, right?
Yep. Even if your essay is 250 words, you're probably not stretching out to the higher bands there, because there's just not enough discussion of the ideas. Yeah.
For task response, I think you'd be struggling to write a band 7 essay just in on or around 250. And also, if you're only writing 200 words, not only are your ideas probably not developed, but you're probably not just showing the examiner enough grammar structures to get a high score, right? You've probably got a limited range of sentence structures, maybe not enough examples of high-level lexis. I mean, it is, in a way, it's good that there's no automatic penalty, because if you write, you know, 10 words less, you're not immediately losing a band for task response. But now it's going to, it could affect more than task response. So yeah, don't write an under-length essay. It's it's not a good idea, and it's, you know, almost a sure way of achieving a lower score than you deserve. And then, all right, the next one, Nick, is it okay to give your personal opinion and be heavier on one side, even though the essay question, or if the essay question only asks you to discuss the advantages and disadvantages?
Your personal opinion shouldn't be in the essay at all if it asks you to discuss the advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is kind of an interesting one, because, you know, there's more than one type of advantage and disadvantage essay, right? I guess this one is the one that, where it's usually only ever appears in the general training test, and it just says, what are the advantages and disadvantages? That's it. Neutral. It's a description essay.
Yeah.
Which is different to, do the advantages outweigh the disadvantages, or are there more advantages than disadvantages? I mean, you just don't do it is the answer, right? You definitely have to address the question. I mean, where would we penalise that student who wrote with a strong opinion?
Task response.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would struggle to give more than a 6, I think.
Probably,
I don't think I'd go lower than a 6. If they still discuss the advantages and disadvantages, you can probably still get a 6. But I would struggle to give a 7 to a student who did that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So just don't do it, right? You're not being asked your personal opinion in that essay. You are being asked to give a neutral description. Okay. All right, and then this last one, Nick. If someone is getting a constant 6.5 for like four times, a 6.5 exclamation mark, what can be the reason? The grammar or the task achievement, task response? Since one has gotten the structure checked from multiple IELTS experts. That's from Ayesha. What would you say to Ayesha?
Well, if the structure's fine, then probably it's weak arguments or underdeveloped arguments.
Right. Well, I mean, if the structure's fine, or like you've got all of the right ingredients, then that would suggest that the coherence and cohesion score would be okay. But my question for you would be, what are these multiple IELTS experts telling you? Because certainly when we mark, structure is just one very small part of what we're checking for, right? And we've got lots of students who, you know, follow the course, they've put everything into practice, they've got the structure, but maybe they don't extend their, like maybe their ideas don't address the question, maybe they're not extended, that's task response, right? They could also have multiple grammar issues.
They could, yeah.
I've got no idea. Maybe you don't have a big enough range of sentence structures. Maybe you've got, what are the common problems? Subject verb agreement.
Maybe poor paraphrasing, poor use of synonyms.
I was going to say, for lexis, it could just be that you're trying too hard and are just using
inappropriate
synonyms, which could actually affect your coherence and cohesion, even if your structure was good, because it could make your sentences difficult to read. So the answer to your question is, yes, it could be any of those reasons. I've written a free ebook about the most common problems I saw in each of the four band areas. And I think I've got 5 common problems for each. So that's 20 p- places, which could be a problem, right? So I would say...
It's a good place to start, isn't it? Download that and have a look.
Have a look at my ebook. Also, I'm just a bit worried about what feedback you're getting from experts, because if anyone who is a gen expert, they will be able to tell you what your problem area is.
Yeah, exactly.
So you shouldn't really, after getting feedback, be confused about what your problem area is. You should know, and then you can start working to improve. But as we've, what is it? I think it's like, why is, we've got that episode, why are so many people stuck at a 6.5? I think that's episode 6 or 5.
Yeah, it's an early one, isn't it?
It's a really early one. But we go through all of this. And I guess, you know, the problem with IELTS is you don't get your individual band scores back. So you don't know if it's one or two areas which are causing the problem. But yeah, I mean, definitely you've got to find out before you can improve. All right, let's move on. Nick, we've got some really interesting questions now about vocabulary. So this is one, is the most specific question we've got, but I like it for that reason. Okay, can we use vanish or fading instead of disappearing? Tamara.
Very specific question.
Extremely.
But we probably need a little bit more context, I would say.
That is the answer. This is, I love this question because this is a great example of how students who think of a word and then they think, oh, I've used that word before. Let's go to the thesaurus and find some synonyms, right?
Oh, yes.
So if you looked in a thesaurus, vanish, fading and disappearing would probably all say that they've got the same meaning. But if you think about, I don't know, like a context of extinction of animals. So if I said, I don't know, like the pandas are bleep from the wild, which words would fit that?
Disappearing and vanishing.
Exactly.
But right? Not fading. So,
but you can't say fading because fading makes it sound like, I don't know, like
turning into ghosts.
Yes, the pandas are slowly becoming ghost-like, right? In the same way, I don't know, like if you said, if you're talking about, you know, a pickpocket stole my wallet in Madrid. That happened. And I could see him in the crowd. And then suddenly he...
Yeah, again, we couldn't use faded here, could we?
No. And I think vanish would be the best word, right?
Yeah.
Because vanish like a magician. Is like disappeared suddenly. So the reason I like this question is there are some situations where you might be able to... I don't know if I can think of a situation where you can use fading and vanish and disappearing.
Yeah.
But, you know, vanish means to disappear quickly. Fading is more like when something is slowly losing its...
opacity.
Opacity. That is the word, Nick, I was struggling to find, right? So this is a great example of you've got to understand how words are used in context. And the only way you can do that is to start seeing them and reading them and listening to them and understand when they are used correctly. This is the type of question that we, or the type of activities that we do with our proficiency students. It's all about, you know, in this particular sentence, which of these four words with the same meaning sounds most natural? So, yeah, the answer is no, not always. Okay. The next question, Nick, I mean, I'm going to be honest, I don't have an answer. How can I know that a word synonym is an academic word and can be used in an IELTS essay?
I don't know.
I mean, I think maybe, I think most students would do a lot better if they stopped trying to use academic words.
Trying to sound academic, using words they don't really understand.
I think it's the opposite. I would say that what you're really trying to do is, in any IELTS essay, is communicate a message, is have an argument. So use the words in that sentence that you think communicates your point most clearly. If you don't think it's academic enough, it doesn't matter. It probably, changing it to a more academic word, using that thesaurus again, mm-hmm. will probably get you into trouble unless you know
the exact meaning.
The exact meaning, and you've read it or you've seen it or you've learned it in context. So, yeah, I think that is a much, much, much better way. Stop worrying about if a word is academic and start focusing on just having sentences that have meaning,
mm-hmm.
which is lost when students focus on the academic part.
It's true, yeah.
Yeah. All right, and then the final question about vocabulary, which is from Wakina. She says, hello, I would like to ask you what topics are essential to learn vocabulary for both the written and oral exam, and what podcast could you recommend to gain vocabulary?
Well, unfortunately, I couldn't recommend a specific podcast because I don't actually listen to that many podcasts. Mm-hmm. But we've talked about this before. Things like sort of news, sort of world affairs,
yeah,
history, geography, science, yes. any of these topics can appear in IELTS, writing and speaking.
Yeah.
You know, globalization, the modern world, energy, the yeah. law, green industries, like there are countless topics. All of that is discussed in various different podcasts, whether it's a scientific one or whether it's a sort of news-based one with people yeah. discussing these things. So any podcast that talks about these issues in English, I think would be really good.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say any podcast which is talking about sort of like world issues or social issues. Mm-hmm. I've got a blog post. I'll put a link to it in this. Or you can just go to the listening archives on my blog, blog.myieltsclassroom.com, because I like podcasts. I think I recommended 5. And they all talk about the topics that Nick has just discussed, right? So there's In Our Time, that's a BBC podcast. There's radio that talks about it's a group of academics, so they're coming together and talking lots of different sort of world issues. Radio Lab, which is a science podcast. Mm-hmm. The Illusionist, which is a language podcast. Freakonomics, which is an economics one that can be quite useful. But the thing is, the same topics do repeat again and again and again. And so if you just look at any good IELTS vocabulary book, the most popular one is by, Pauline Cullen, you will see it's a lot of the same stuff. It's all sort of like, if you're a general training student in particular, like health, exercise, student life, working life, communicating, the natural world, design. I mean, maybe try and get hold of that book. I would say that would be a bigger help in terms of learning specific vocabulary for IELTS. But as Nick said, any podcast which is about world topics
mm-hmm.
and that you enjoy will be a great help for your speaking anyway, and listening in any case, won't it?
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Good. All right. We had a couple of questions about generating ideas. You know, how do I think of ideas for essays? To be honest, we've got lots of episodes about this, haven't we?
We do, yeah. Our most popular ones, actually.
Yeah. So episode 35 is dedicated just to how to come up with ideas. But then we've got the ones where we look at recent essay questions and Nick and I explain how we would tackle those. They are episodes 43, 25 and 12. I would just go back and listen to those.
Mm-hmm.
The only other question, I mean, we've got another question from a student who said, I've listened to some of those podcasts, but when I try to write an essay, my mind goes blank and I can't write a single word. What do you think is the problem? What advice would you give to that student?
I think this comes back to something we discussed about 2 minutes ago, which is, you know, podcasts, look at the different topics, try to mm-hmm. read some news articles, some websites about these different topics,
yeah.
form an opinion on these topics about it's global practice. Warming, about life in the city, the positives and the negatives, you know,
yeah.
and that will help you to think of ideas. It's not an easy process, and it's not something that happens overnight, but
no.
Lacking in ideas, for me, even if you do it in your own language, if you read information about this in your own language, you can still form an idea, can't you?
Definitely. Watch... I mean, it's not a language issue, is it?
No, not really. You know, watch some debates on YouTube and decide who you agree with more.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I would say is avoid looking at IELTS model essays for these questions, because 90% of the time the ideas in those are terrible and the language is not much better. Just like you said, try and engage with these topics. You can have a look at all of the past questions that, you know, are on our blog. You can see that the same topics repeat and repeat and repeat. So spend some time now thinking about them. And if your problem is going blank in the exam, that's probably a stress issue. And that means you probably want to go back and maybe listen to the episode we did with Beverly Accor, the psychologist, who spoke about how to deal with stress in the exam. Because if you can think of ideas outside the exam, then it's not really ideas that are the problem, I don't think. It's probably
stress.
Perfectionism and stress and not wanting to commit to a particular idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So I think that was it for the essays. And all we've got left then are a couple of general questions. I never know how to answer this first one, Nick. How do students plan study schedules on a daily basis for each module?
Well, it depends on the student. Each one's different.
Yeah.
I would say you probably want to spend some time doing each module every week while you prepare. Mm-hmm. I think you should definitely focus on ones that you find more difficult. Focus more on the ones that you find more difficult. So if you're struggling with writing, maybe spend extra time practicing writing.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's a magic number. I do think spending 20 to 30 minutes every day is a good start, if you can.
I mean, it says on a daily basis for each module. My answer would be, I don't think it's very realistic.
No, not every day for each module. That's too much.
It's too much. And, you know, unless you were doing, you know, some of the classes that I've taught in the past were topic-based classes. So we might take the topic of, say, the environment, and we might do a listening, which is about the environment, and then a reading, and then write an essay. In that way, that can be a good way of actually covering all the modules under the umbrella
of a specific topic.
But that would be hard for a student to do on their own, I think.
That usually needs a teacher to find all the materials and set the whole class up.
And connect it all together. I would just say I think what Nick says perfect about know what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are. And I would say, you know, if you know that you're already got the scores you need at a reading or listening, you probably don't really need to spend much more time on them. Just every now and then, just
refresh.
Brush up on the skills. Yeah. But I would say you want to really break down each of the modules, right? Reading is not just reading, is it? It's like the different types of questions, the different topics. I think you probably need help. Like anything, like I would say, you know, you probably need help maybe to understand what skills you're missing. Maybe just do one module each day, like something for one module, right? Learn some new vocabulary or practice writing introductions to essays or try and do focus on skills rather than doing all of it. Because the same student also asks, is it good to have a mock test every day or once a week?
Every day is a terrible idea.
I mean, yeah. Why is it a terrible idea? I mean, we're laughing. To us, that's obvious. But why would it be a terrible idea?
Do you really want to sit down for 3 hours every day?
Right.
And do a full mock test. And then you don't even have time to process what you've done, where you've gone wrong, where you've made mistakes.
And what before has changed? You know
it, yeah, what's changed?
Since the day before.
Yeah. The best way to do it is not even once a week, is to do a mock test, I would say. You're going to have to find a way to get your marking and to get your writing and speaking marked. And then you need to analyze your results, where you've gone wrong, and then work on those areas.
Yeah.
And probably, a week is not enough time to do that.
I don't think a week, not if you've done the full test, right? Yeah. So you've got problems in listening, reading, speaking. I mean, I was thinking about this. I think the best analogy I could make is when you're on a diet, I understand that when you know for 2 or 3 days. You haven't eaten, you know, you haven't had the chocolate that you usually eat. Mm-hmm. And you just constantly like, have I lost weight? Have I lost weight? Right. So you might want to get on the scales all the time to check if you've lost weight. So I understand maybe it's the same thing, right? The students want to take a test because they want to see if they've improved. But if you step on the scales every day, you're probably not going to see hardly any change.
Yeah, it's true.
Right?
Yeah.
And it gets demotivating. Whereas if you weighed yourself once a month,
you would see the difference, wouldn't you?
A huge drop in weight. So, you know, just because we've got these Cambridge books, you know, we've discussed this before. The worst thing you could do is rush through those tests in the hope that it will help you to improve. I would say once you've done 2 or 3 and you know the basic format, maybe once a week. I would say once every 2 or 3 weeks, to be honest. As a teacher, you know, we had all of those Cambridge books at our school, Nick, and I only, in that 10-week course, did, I think, 3 tests. Because the rest of the time, I was more focused on teaching skills.
Teaching,
grammar points, Lexis, how to tackle different questions. Like, yeah, there's so much to be learning that for me, constant testing is just a waste of time.
Yeah.
It's great if you want to, if you've worked on something in particular and you want to see if you've improved, but just doing it in the hope that you might have improved. Because, you know, if we go on with our weight loss analogy, if you weigh yourself on Monday and then don't change your diet and eat rubbish all week, you can't get back on the scales the next week and expect there to be an improvement, can you?
No.
So if all you are doing is testing, that is a waste of time. Right. So, two final things. One other question I got, Nick. I will not say the name for this, but let's just read this one. Dear Sir or Madam, I would like to ask a question about the art certificate for Band 5. Honestly, I can read, speak and understand English language. I just want a certificate. So, is it possible to provide me an art certificate without exam? If so, kindly let me know how much I need to pay for that. I would like to thank you for your time, consideration and forthcoming response. So, obviously, Nick, I've already replied to the student. They've paid us £2,000. That'll be our bonus. So I'll send you over half next week. We can have a week off. Obviously, I mean, we don't talk about this, but you cannot buy a fake certificate.
Nope.
You can buy a certificate.
If you want.
Which someone has photoshopped. Look very nice. But as soon as you try to use that to migrate, or to apply for university, they will check the number and it will not be in the IELTS database.
And it'll just be rejected.
It'll be rejected and that'll be the end of your, well, the end of everything, basically.
Yeah, because if you try to cheat migration, they're not going to let you in the future.
No, that's it. You've got an automatic ban. I don't know how many years it is, but it's at least 3. What makes me sad about this email is that this student needs a band 5.
Which is not that high, to be honest.
It's not that high. And if they can read and speak and understand English, you know...
Just take the exam.
Just take the exam. Take a course. You can pay... going back to what I said at the beginning of the lesson, pay £35 for our course, take the exam. It will be far cheaper than paying for a fake certificate. Mm-hmm. And then you won't have to spend your whole life worrying that migration are going to come and knock on your door. So, yeah, I just put that one in because it made me laugh. But there are, Nick... 2 questions we received, which we haven't answered today.
Okay.
And they are both about examples. The first question was just very simply, my question is how to give examples in IELTS essays. And the second question was about, can we use personal examples? Now, I've had 3 or 4 of our students who've emailed me recently to ask about examples. I have done my best to avoid ever having to make an episode about examples. Because it makes me emotional. But I think the time has come.
Oh, dear.
So I think that we will pause on this idea of examples and how to give good examples.
Okay.
And you can come back next week and I will explain in the clearest way possible what a good example is and what it definitely isn't. Studies have shown me that I was voted the world's sexiest woman in 2021. I mean, you can say anything, can't you? What would be a fun example, just like, that we can say studies have shown?
Research has shown that having a curfew decreases murder by 55%.
That's good. So that's what we'll be discussing in the next episode. To make sure you don't miss it, remember to subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or any podcast provider. And we'll see you next week. My IELTS Classroom podcast is a production of My IELTS Classroom Limited. Nick and I do not represent IELTS, and everything you heard in this episode is our own personal opinion. You can find the show notes and transcript for this episode on our blog. That's blog.myieltsclassroom.com. And if you're looking for our video courses, speaking lessons, and marking service, you can find that at www.myieltsclassroom.com. If you have a question or query or just want to chat, you can email Nick and I at hello@myieltsclassroom.com. Our theme music is by Heartbeat, and our artwork is produced by David Brown. Have a great week, study hard, and remember, this is my IELTS classroom. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.